Memorial Day, and we come to think about this issue of what it means to live in a land that has these extraordinary privileges and freedoms we enjoy. We hear it said repeatedly, freedom is not free. And that seems like a conundrum in a way. What do you mean, freedom's not free? And of course, if you saw the movie Secretariat this last year, you know there was a scene in that movie where that became a point of contention between a young teenage daughter who was wrestling with her own issues about a war that our nation was in at that time, and her father who was defending certain principles, and he talked to her about freedom not being free, and she said, well, what's the point then? You know, it's like you have to have freedom. I think what we misunderstand so often is that the possession of freedom does not cost us. We're able to go out and gather together in assembly and speak openly our minds and our values and to enjoy the opportunities of our land without too much restriction. But the protection of that freedom is what costs. Because as we exercise our freedom, we find that there are those both within our country and outside who, for various reasons, want to limit that exercise and want to restrict and sometimes even take away the privileges that we enjoy. And so while the possession of that freedom certainly is free and the exercise of that freedom comes with only the limited restraints that we as ourselves as society put on ourselves, it is the protection of that freedom that costs so much. And it's good for us to have that in mind and to, from time to time, remember and celebrate that there are those who paid the price for our freedom. So on this Memorial Day, we're going to take a little look at how we celebrate those who have purchased our freedom and protected our freedom and how it can affect our thoughts not only about our land but also about our faith. Excuse me. My father is a World War II veteran, and so that means I grew up in a home where some of that memorabilia was hanging around the house. And I was one of those kids who remembered actually putting on my dad's uniform when I was a kid. And so, you know, I remember that kind of heavy, scratchy wool that the uniforms were made out of in those days. And I also remember the smell of mothballs, which is what happens to a uniform that's been hanging in the closet for 25 years till the kid drags it out. And I had then played with it. And somewhere around the house I still have the cap that my dad had from his uniform with the insignia of his service at that time. And as I've come to know my dad, I've come to realize that those years, although they were relatively brief in his life, only a little over 3.5 years that he spent in the service during World War II, they were years that shaped his life in so many ways. In my dad's case, they not only shaped his life as a citizen of this country and as an individual who is part of that generation, so often called the greatest generation, but in my dad's case, it also shaped his faith, because it was during his years as a corporal in World War II that a chaplain in the military took my dad under his wing and both discipled him and encouraged him in his walk of faith, so that when my dad finished his military career, he was encouraged not to pursue the life he had planned in a woodworking institution, Dakota Sash and Door, but he was persuaded to go and consider studying for the ministry, which my dad did and eventually became a pastor. And so much happened in those years that my dad considers those among the most important of his life. And I've learned over the years that that's true of many of the individuals who served during that conflict. And it's appropriate that in recent times we have come to recognize that through the establishment of a memorial in Washington, D.C. And some of you have had a chance to either see, visit, or hear about the new World War II Memorial, which has opened recently in our nation's capital. And it is a stunning piece of both architecture and history. And for those of us who appreciate such things, we feel it's beautiful, we feel it's appropriate, we feel it's a great way to honor our service people who served during that particular conflict. As I think of that, we come to understand that memorials matter to us. I know it certainly mattered to those veterans who served in this war, and they waited decades before this memorial was established. When you think of how quickly the Vietnam Memorial went up for the men and women who served in that conflict to how long it took for the World War II Memorial to go up, you kind of have to stop and wonder a little bit about why. And yet, for all the reasons that may have been there, it is great to see it happen now. And the individuals who are part of this generation now come there, and in dwindling numbers, but with fervent hearts, they come to experience this opportunity to see a place set aside for them and the sacrifice they made. For some of you who know my dad, you know that he is someone who is terrified to fly. A little ironic since his son is a pilot. My dad has actually flown with me 3 times in his life. I think the longest of those 3 flights was 10 minutes. About every 5 years, he decides that, you know, just to be with my boy, I'm going to get in the plane and fly with him. And so he says, I'm ready. I can do this. And so we get him in the plane. And just about the time the wheels are off the ground, he goes, I've had enough. And we kind of go around the airport and land again. For those of you who know this area, I fly out of the Springboro Airport down here. I got him all the way to Caesars Creek once and then had to, you know, endure his panic while we flew back to land at Springboro. So that's my dad. Well, I tell you because one of the things that's being done now is this program that's just wonderful called Honor Flight, where pilots will take World War II veterans from wherever they are and get them to the World War II Memorial. And my dad won't do that. He won't fly with me. He won't fly with commercial. He won't fly with Honor Flight. He won't fly with anybody. Excuse me. I understand that there are some who are taking buses, and we're talking about that. But I really want my dad to see this because it's such an important part of his life. I understand that the mall there, the reflecting pool, is under construction this summer, and that's going to, of course, affect the impact. But nonetheless, I would love to have my dad get there. So I'm really considering taking the time off to drive from here to Wisconsin and put my dad in the car to drive from Wisconsin to Washington to let my dad see the memorial so I can drive my dad from Washington to Wisconsin to take him back home again so I can drive from Wisconsin back here to be with my family. And so if I'm gone for about 3 months this summer, you'll understand why. But I really believe it's that important for my dad to see this place. And you say, why? He's 91 years old. It's been 70 years almost since he had that experience. He was brought into the military in 1941 after Pearl Harbor as a 21-year-old man who'd been working the farms of Iowa. Why after 70 years would you want to go through all of that to bring him back to this place? That's because memorials matter. They do. Setting aside a piece of ground and giving it shape and form and identity, imbuing it with the heritage and the history and the experiences and calling generations to come to experience, there's real value in that. And we sometimes forget how much value there is. And all you have to do is witness the men and women who go to this memorial and who bring with them their now somewhat older children or their grandchildren or in some cases their great-grandchildren, and you'll understand why this place is important to them. And it should be to us too. As Americans, it should be to us. And there are memorials that go beyond just this one and the memorials we have in Washington, D.C. There are actually memorials in Scripture. And I would ask you, if you would, to open your copy of God's Word to the book of Joshua. Now, that's near the front. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, those books of Moses. And you come right after that to the book which tells the history of God's people as they came into the land. That's the book of Joshua, one of the histories. And go to the back of that book in Joshua chapter 24. In Joshua 24, we're going to understand that there is a memorial built in Israel for the people of Israel at this time as they come into the land. It's a memorial built at the city of Shechem. And we first encounter this in Joshua chapter 24, and there in verses 25 and following. It says this, "On that day Joshua made a covenant for the people, and there at Shechem he drew up for them the decrees and laws. And Joshua recorded these things in the book of the law of God. And then he took a large stone and set it up there under the tree near the holy place of the Lord. See, he said to all the people, this stone will be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God." What this is a memorial. And here's what specifically is said. See, he said to all the people, this stone will be a witness against us. It has heard all the words the Lord has said to us. It will be a witness against you if you are untrue to your God. Now, to put this in context, we have to understand that it is not the World War II memorial we're talking about here. It did not take 70 years to build. It did not cost millions of dollars. It did not take thousands of people working endless, tireless hours to construct. It was a rock. It was probably a big rock. It says stone, but given the structure, it was probably a big rock, a rock that had to be moved and positioned and stood up. It probably was a rock big enough that it had some presence and people could identify it. It's kind of the Plymouth Rock of Israel, if you will. I think about this and I think about, you know, the rock that's over at Cedarville University. For those who have close contact with Cedarville University, you know the rock is there. You know, it's this good-sized piece of, I don't know, what, granite or something, and it gets painted and decorated by the students, and it has for as long as, you know, I can remember. The rock was there when I was a student. I was actually over there recently with a friend of mine of the same generation of mine, and somebody was talking about the rock, and they said, when we were there, the rock was only this big. Yeah, right. Well, we're old, we're not that old. No, the rock didn't grow. It's been there the whole time, and people have been working. And the rock is kind of a link along the history of Cedarville University students. And that's the way that this was supposed to be. It was a memorial. It was a memorial to what had happened with God's people. And to put that in context, you need to go back to your Bibles for just a second and look at the beginning of chapter 24 here in Joshua. It says, then Joshua assembled all the tribes of Israel at Shechem, and he summoned the elders, leaders, judges, and officials of Israel, and they presented themselves before God. And Joshua said to all the people, this is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Long ago, your forefathers, including Terah, the father of Abraham, and Nahor, lived beyond the river and worshipped other gods. But I took your father Abraham from the land beyond the river, and I led him throughout Canaan, and I gave him many descendants. I gave him Isaac, and to Isaac I gave Jacob and Esau, and I signed the hill country of Seir and Esau to Esau, but Jacob and his sons went down to Egypt. And then I sent Moses and Aaron, and I afflicted the Egyptians by what I did there, and I brought you out. And when I brought your fathers out of Egypt, you came to the sea, and the Egyptians pursued them with chariots and horsemen as far as the Red Sea. But they cried to the Lord for help, and he put darkness between you and the Egyptians. And he brought you over the sea, he brought the sea over them and covered them. And you saw with your own eyes what I did to the Egyptians. And then you lived in the desert for a long time. And I brought you to the land of the Amorites who lived east of the Jordan, and they fought against you, but I gave them into your hands. And I destroyed them from before you, and you took possession of their land. When Balak, the son of Zippor, the king of Moab, prepared to fight against Israel, he sent for Balaam, the son of Beor, to put a curse on you, but I would not listen to Balaam. And so he blessed you again and again, and I delivered you out of his hand. And then you crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho, and the citizens of Jericho fought against you, as did also the Amorites, Perizzites, Canaanites, Hittites, Girgashites, Hivites, and Jebusites. But I gave them into your hands, and I set the hornet ahead of you, which drove them out before you, also the two Amorite kings, and you did not go with your own sword and bow. So I gave you your land, a land which you did not toil, and cities that you did not build, and you live in them, and eat from their vineyards and olive groves that you did not plant. And now fear the Lord, and serve him with all faithfulness. The story is that this is the end of Joshua's life. And here he recounts all of these extraordinary events and victories that God has brought his people through. To really give you a feel of what's happening, you have to remember that Joshua was there in Egypt with Moses and Aaron. He'd been a younger man at that time, but nonetheless he was a full-grown man, and he had lived through that time of captivity. He'd lived through that time of slavery, but he'd also lived to see God's great hand in redeeming his people. He'd been there when they crossed the Red Sea, and he'd come to that place called Kadesh Barnea, and he and Caleb had been among the 12 spies that went in to scout out the land. And they realized the land was occupied and was well defended, and there were, as they said, giants in the land. And among those 12 spies, Joshua was the only one, along with Caleb, to say, in spite of all of that, God is with us, we can take the land. But the other 10 spies said, nope. Too much for us. Enemies are too great. Powers are too strong. And so because the people did not trust their God, God said to the people, fine, you will not inherit the land. And that entire generation went off and wandered in the desert. And all those who were more than 20 years old at the time they'd come to Kadesh Barnea, died in the wilderness, never coming to the land. Finally, they come to the Jordan River. That generation is gone. A new generation is placed. They're about to cross in, and God calls Moses home. He turns to Joshua, and he says, Joshua, now you'll be my leader. Now think about it. Joshua is at this point an old man. He spent a life in Egypt and a second life wandering the desert, 40 years out in the desert. At a time when most men should be retiring and playing with their children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, God says, now I want you to become the general of my army. And so Joshua leads them into the promised land. And all these stories you just heard recounted happened under Joshua's leadership. And you come to a point now where the land is essentially controlled. Oh, there's going to be, you know, we call them mopping up operations. The judges are going to take care of some things here and there. David will come and consolidate the kingdom and expand it further. But the real work is done. The people have their land. The tribes have been distributed. They're in position and the land is theirs. And Joshua is about to go home. And he says to his people, come here. I want to talk with you. And so the leaders and the officials, and they all gather at this place called Shechem. There's a lot of reasons for that. We're not going to go into that now. It was a holy place to the Lord, a place that God had set aside and met his people and done great work there. And so he comes to this place called Shechem. And Joshua wants to have a final word with the people of Israel. He tells them this great story about where they have come from and how God has blessed them. And then he sets before them a bit of a challenge. And in verses 14 and following, he says this, now fear the Lord and serve him with faithfulness. Throw away the gods of your that your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Think about that for just a minute. This is Joshua, old now, lived through Egypt, lived through the wilderness, lived through the conquest, and now gathers the people. And his message is, okay, you've got a choice. I find that amazing. I'd be standing up and saying, all right, here's the way it's going to be, folks. Will you look at what we've been through, and will you look at what's been accomplished? Now, this is how you need to work. From here on out, you need to follow God, and you need to follow Him this way. And I'd be laying out the plan and the order and the structure, and I'd be expecting people to, you know, man up and get behind the program. And Joshua comes, and he says, all of you out there, this whole generation, here's what I think you need to be aware of. God has been good to you. So I'm going to encourage you to fear the Lord and follow Him. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, if it doesn't seem like what you want to do, well, then choose today who you're going to serve. It's your choice. I'm done. I've been doing this a long time. I'm old. I'm tired. Got a few battle scars, you know. Things don't work like they used to. Now, as for me and my house, we know what's going on here. Whether the gods your forefathers served beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you were living, you've got a choice to make. But as for me and my house, we're going to serve Jehovah. Now, we come to this verse and we quote it all the time. You know, Joshua out there, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And we want that to be our rallying cry. But we forget to put it in the context. When he said that, it wasn't a rallying cry in that context. It came right after he said, here's the way it's going to be. Me and my house, we're going to serve Jehovah. You've got a choice to make. What are you going to do? You know, it reminds me that every generation has a choice to make. Every generation has a choice to make. And it doesn't matter whether you're talking about our faith or you're talking about our nation. If we realize with our faith, that's why we're so committed to children's work and Sunday schools and camps and VBS and programs that minister to children, because we understand that if we don't teach the next generation, they're one generation away from being godless and being lost. One generation away from heresy. One generation away from Satan. when my children are born into the world, they don't know God. They're born in that same sense of being human beings caught with the burden of sin that we all were born with. And if I don't teach them, if the church doesn't teach them, if a friend doesn't teach them, if a neighbor doesn't teach them, if somebody doesn't teach them, they will never know God. One generation away from heresy, apostasy, and lostness. But you know, it's true for a nation as well. Every new nation has to grow. And if they don't know the history, if they don't understand the heritage, if they're not taught what happened when those people who wanted freedom, and first and foremost, the freedom to worship, the freedom to speak openly, the freedom to assemble, not for the sake of deciding who's going to be the next American Idol, but the fact that they wanted to assemble to see who they would worship as God. But that was a freedom which they enjoyed because a group of people left a land where they were not counted that freedom and came to this nation. If we don't teach them that, they may not understand the extraordinary freedoms and why they have them. And they may not care about them or protect them as somebody else would come along and take them away. Every generation has a choice what they're going to do with this nation they've received. And memorials are one of the ways that we start to link the heritage together and teach the generations so they will make a wise choice. We do it by showing them the choice of those made earlier. What choice did your father make and your grandfather make and your great-grandfather and your great-great-grandfather before that? What choice did they make and why? And if you come and see their choice and understand it, maybe you'll be better equipped to make the choice that you need to make. That's what Joshua did here. And this is what they said. They said, "Then the people answered, 'Far be it from us to forsake the Lord, to serve other gods. It was the Lord our God Himself who brought us and our fathers up out of Egypt.'" I find that really interesting when he says that. "And performed those great signs before our eyes." Only those that were under 20 years old at the time they hit Kadesh Barnea. The whole rest of that generation had died in the wilderness. But somehow they knew it. Our eyes and our father's eyes. You know, I have a feeling that in all those wanderings, when Junior was growing up, and he got to be 10, and then 20, and then 30, and then 40. Remember, the child born the first day after Kadesh Barnea was 40 years old when they crossed the Jordan into Canaan. Along the way, he must have said, Dad, whose idea was it to wander out here in the desert? You know, I saw a couple great oases along the way we could have stopped at. Why are we doing this?" And Dad had to say, "You know, son, I need to tell you a story. Before you were born, there was this place called Egypt. You've never seen it. You've maybe heard about it from the caravans that passed, but it was a mighty empire. Huge, beautiful architecture, great wealth, strong armies, but we were their slaves. And God brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand and extraordinary miracles. He brought us out of Egypt. Let me tell you about that." And all this time, son sitting out there in the tent in the desert. No big buildings, no great wealth, a little manna in the morning, some water from a rock in the evening. Must have sounded like fairy tales to them. But he saw it in his father's eyes and he heard it in his father's voice and he understood that it was true and a heritage was passed on. And when they come to this point, yes, now they've seen the conquest of the land. They've seen what happened to the Ammonites. They've seen what happened to all the various sites in there. And they say, "We have seen what our God does. We will serve the Lord. He protected us on our entire journey and among all the nations through which we traveled. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord because He is our God." And so they make this promise to Joshua. And Joshua says, "I'm glad to hear it. It's great that you've experienced this." And they did. You know, they must have gotten along the way. He protected us, you know, manna and water and shoes that didn't wear out and clothing that didn't wear out and protection. And they came to these kings and the kings fled before them without hardly doing anything. And they said, "Wow, this has been amazing. Our God protected us. Yeah, we'll serve Him." But Joshua knew how the people were. He said, "This is great right now, but you know what's going to happen? You're going to get settled in and you're going to forget. You are. You're going to forget. No, we'll never forget. We didn't forget in all 40 years. You're going to forget. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to build this memorial. That's what we read in verse 27. Put this stone, and the stone is going to be a witness. This stone has heard all the words that you've said. And when you come to this stone, you're going to be reminded, because this stone is set up here, that you took a covenant oath before God, and it was a covenant oath based on a whole history of experiences. When we were at the Moody Conference this week, and by the way, I just need to say thank you for that. It's such a great privilege that you give your staff a chance to go to the Moody Pastors Conference. We do so many things. We have a chance to get away from the work and just spend time together, camaraderie, you know, fun. We have a chance to challenge each other. Of course, we go to the services, we go to the seminars, we get encouraged, we get taught some things that hopefully we'll use to help us and to help you. Great time together. If you see Pastor Josh, just ask him about lunch. We always try to go to a nice restaurant once and celebrate the staff. We usually do it in the evening, but we chose to do lunch this time because of the activities that were happening the rest of the day. Went to a place called Fogo de Chao. Some of you may know it. It's a Brazilian churrascaria. They bring out all these meats on skewers and swords, and they just start slicing the meat off on your plate. And you know, you get 16 different kinds of meat at lunch, 24 if you go for dinner. You know, they just bring fillets and strips Parmesan pork and bacon-wrapped chicken and various kinds of sausages, and they just keep coming, and they just keep coming, and they just keep coming, and you know, you got six guys there, and it's like a man feast. At one point, about halfway through the third piece of Parmesan pork, Josh looks up from his plate and he goes, "Oh man, I got the meat sweats." Good time. Well, it's not all about that. It's also about some things that happen in our teaching together. I just want to make sure I'm at the right place. Okay, I am. I want to make sure it's the right place. I got confused in the first service and kind of lost my place. We had a pastor there teaching us. He's Lon Solomon. And if you guys have heard of Lon Solomon, he's the pastor of McLean Bible Church out in Washington, D.C., where the memorial is. A man who was raised with the heritage of a Jew and who came to find Jesus as Messiah and then came to be called in the pastoral ministry and leads one of the largest evangelical churches on the East Coast, right there in Washington, D.C., has the privilege of ministering to senators and congressmen and leaders in all branches of the government and members of the military and just a really outstanding guy. And he's kind of a rough, brusque, in-your-face kind of guy, if you know him. And in the course of his preaching out in McLean Bible, in the course of what he was teaching there at Moody this week, he has this way of getting the people involved. And after he's given the whole build-up, kind of like I have done right now, and he's giving you the background and he's giving you the history, he comes and he says, "Yeah, but what does that matter?" And so he goes, "Folks, we're at that point in the message. One, two, three." And his people all yell out, "So what?" That's pretty good. Because if you've been sitting here all day and there's no "so what" when you leave, then you've just wasted your time and mine. So here it is, folks. We're talking about memorials. We've got all this history. You've just learned about everything that happened at Joshua's time when he put a rock under a tree at Shechem. And your answer to all of that teaching is one, two, three. Oh, come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. You've just heard about Israel and all that God did. And what Joshua did is he came to the end of his ministry and he put this big rock under a tree at Shechem. And your answer to that is one, two, three.
So what?
Yeah, so what? So what? Another way to say that is, what benefit do we get from a memorial? Whether it's at Shechem or in Washington or anywhere else, what benefit do we really get from a memorial? I want to suggest to you what we see in Joshua 1 through 27 here are a number of benefits we get from a memorial, and we're going to cover them real quickly now in the so what. But there are four things that I've identified that a memorial can do for us. And the first one is a memorial reminds us of the choices that are faced. That's what he said in verse 15. He said, "But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve." If serving the Lord seems undesirable, you know what a memorial does? It reminds us of why those choices were faced and why it was good that people made the choices they did. You see, it's easy to forget that in 1936 and 1937 and 1938 and 1939, Adolf Hitler was considered a pretty sharp guy. Charismatic, well-organized, leading his people out of economic chaos that they had endured since the 20s. And the leaders around Europe were actually quite impressed with the way that he had organized the German state. In fact, in 1936 and 37, when he was getting greedy about a place called the Sudetenland, which became Czechoslovakia eventually, and he moved his forces in there and took control of it, leaders like the Prime Minister of Britain, a man named Neville Chamberlain, probably known only to crazy historians and a few World War II buffs, established a policy called appeasement. Now that doesn't sound real good to us today, partly because we saw what happened back in 1937 with a policy called appeasement. But it was the official policy of the British Empire. And it pretty much said, you know, really all Hitler's trying to do is stabilize the economy, and he wants that rich farmland and some of that industrial power that's over there along that eastern coast of his. And so we should appease him. We should find ways of letting him have what he wants and feel good about himself there in Germany, and then he'll leave the rest of us alone. You think? But that's what it looked like then. And so in 36 and 37 and 38 and on into 39, even after he invaded Austria and Poland, the British were saying, we don't want another war. It wasn't until May of 1940, after a crisis in Norway, that the British realized that this thing isn't going to stop. But they'd actually come to the aid of their allies in late 1939, and they had declared war, but it was being waged in a completely ineffective and unsupported way. In a crisis vote in Parliament in May of 1940, Neville Chamberlain's government was finally undone. And a young Lord of the Admiralty by the name of Winston Churchill was made Prime Minister. As they say, the rest is history. We forget that choices were made about whether that war was worth fighting in the first place. Oh, and it didn't just happen in Britain. Back in America, even after all of that, there was a sense that, yeah, we don't want to get involved. That's a European war. That's a continental war. Let's just remember that we got the big pond between us, and let's just keep ourselves safe for democracy here. Well, that had been the cry back in World War I. Woodrow Wilson got elected with the pledge, he kept us out of war, and that spirit had permeated on through, on to the day that we were talking about right here. And it wasn't until we ourselves were attacked at Pearl Harbor in December of 41 that we decided that this was something we had to get involved with. See, going back and having that memorial reminds us there were choices that were made. And the choice could have been that we didn't want to have any part of it. And where would the world have been then? But a choice was made to get involved. And those millions of men who served and women who served in World War II got involved and went over to a place that wasn't theirs, to a country that wasn't theirs, to a people who wasn't theirs, to a language who wasn't theirs. And whether in the Atlantic or the Pacific, they fought and they died. And the world was a better place. And I'm bold enough to say that. There's no relativism about that. The world was a better place because that generation made the choice to fight for truth and freedom. A memorial reminds us that other generations have faced choices. As Christians, we need to know that other generations have faced choices. I had this extraordinary reality that other generations have faced choices. My dad faced a choice. See, he wasn't a believer when he went into World War I. Actually, he had just been brought to a place of faith by an aunt before he went, kind of saying, you know, you're going off to war, you might die, you better think about this, son. During his experience there, a chaplain discipled my father. And my dad, who thought he was going to be working at Dakota Sash and Door in woodworking, making windows and doors and frames for houses, my dad was challenged to consider that maybe God had a call on his life, and maybe God wanted him to go to Bible school, and maybe God wanted him to be a minister. And that chaplain, at his duty post in Panama, talked him into considering going to Bible college, which my dad did on the GI Bill when he got out of World War II, became a pastor. My dad had choices to make. But he made those choices because he had a mother who was a believer who challenged him, and an aunt who was a believer who challenged him, because they had a father who was a believer who challenged them, because he had a father who was a believer who challenged him. And in fact, that man was a Tewksbury from England who traced his heritage all the way back to a man in Tewksbury in England called John Farmer. And that man named John Farmer, and I said Anderson the first service, it was, I don't know what I was thinking, my mind glitched, but his name was John Farmer. And John Farmer was a man who was one day challenged to consider whether he would renounce his faith or die. And you know he did. He recanted of his faith. Then later he came back and he said, I can't do that. I am a follower of Jesus Christ. And so they burned him at the stake in the early 1500s. And that particular story is told in the unabridged version of Fox's Book of Martyrs. And that's one of my great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers. Heritage told by choices that were made for generations that have come down to mine. And so my dad looks at me and he says, son, you've got a choice to make. You can follow the world or you can follow Christ. But let me tell you about your heritage. See, that's the second thing. It reminds us of a heritage one. A memorial reminds us that these choices have led to certain identities that are real. They're who we are. They're how we stand. They're what we believe. They have directed us. My dad would tell me about the security of his family and the security of the families around him. These were families which cared and loved and forgave and supported and nurtured and encouraged because they believed in something called truth and justice. When we think of truth and justice, we kind of think that they're absolutes, right? They're not. I mean, they are, but they're not viewed that way. The world out there would tell us it's all relative. Do you understand that in a world that's relative, where there is no truth, you can have no right and wrong. If you have no right and wrong, you can have no justice. Without justice, the world becomes simply who can manage it to their own end. Manipulated. Because we have a heritage of faith and a knowledge of God, we have an understanding of truth. And with that truth comes an understanding of right and wrong. With an understanding of right and wrong comes a concept called justice. And we have truth and justice. And dare I say, the American way? Because along the line, certain people made choices, and those choices led to the establishment of principles, and those principles underpinned a form of government that valued the individual, that valued concepts of right and wrong, that valued truth and heritage, and we live in this land of freedom and justice because of a heritage of people who made choices, and the monuments we have remind us of those choices and of that heritage. And so we go to a place like Washington, D.C., we take our kids there and we look and we say, this happened in a time called 1941, and it happened in a time called 1864, and it happened in a time called 1773 or 4 or 6 or 8. And there was a period of time when we were under a rule that did not let us gather together to worship our God freely. And so we said, enough of that, and the colony became the republic. We gathered together as independent states that were not effective and not efficient, and we're supporting this extraordinarily difficult and sometimes horrendous thing called slavery, and we said, enough. We now gathered into a nation that was both economically strong and at least morally one step further down the road with emancipation. We gathered together as that nation and we looked at a horror across the seas and we said, we're going to take a stand for what is right and what is just. And the world was a better place. A heritage won. A memorial also reminds us of the peace enjoyed. When you stand there and you look, you realize we've had a tremendous period of peace. We've had a tremendous period of peace. Oh, there have been skirmishes and conflicts, but you know what? The superpower has done its job. It really has. We have not yet, again, had a world conflict like 1918 and most notably 1940. And what's really amazing about that is in that peace, our enemies have become our allies. Germany became our ally. Japan became our ally. In fact, there is a solid historical argument to be made that because of the values, and I'm sorry if this sounds a little polemic, but I really believe because of the values of the American people that they inherited through the heritage of the choices were made by people going back for generations. Choices were rooted many, many times in the concrete scriptures and the view of mankind that they taught. There was a sense that if we treated our enemies with respect and opportunity, and Germany became a strong economic power because of its relationship with the United States, and Japan became a strong economic power because of its relationship with the United States, we did not go in and conquer them for our own benefit. We went in with the values and the heritage. And you know what came out of that? What came out of that is an era of peace like we have seldom seen. The memorials remind us of that. And the memorials remind us mostly of the price paid. I haven't been to the new World War II memorial. I hope to go there. I understand there's a section where they highlight those who gave the ultimate sacrifice. I have been to the Vietnam memorial, my generation's memorial. I looked for one of my friends from high school who I know died. I didn't find the name. I didn't go through the right process. I know there's a process that you go through to actually find where it is on the wall. I learned that after I was there. So I didn't find my friend's name. I hope to go back someday and do that. But I was there and have seen others who found their friends or loved ones or family members' names. I've watched them as they touch the wall. I've seen them take their hands and trace their fingers through the letters. Watch them cry. Understand the price that was paid. Price paid not only by those who gave the ultimate sacrifice, but paid by all who sacrificed. Those who served, those who were wounded, those who came back changed, even those who stayed behind and dealt with the realities of what it does to a people and an economy. Whether the memorial is the one to World War II or the one to Vietnam or the one to Korea or the one to the Civil War or the one to the colonial period, these memorials remind us that in our history, a price has been paid for everything we enjoy. Memorials are good. And the same is true as we think of our faith. Every one of us has a choice to make about our faith, and the choice is simply this, Jesus or not. Do you really understand it is that simple? It is Jesus or not. I am the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus was bold enough to say. And He proved it by demonstrating that He was God and in control of this universe when He rose from the dead. And He said, it's this simple. You can follow your own path and see where it leads, or you can believe in Me and I'll take you to heaven. But you have to make the choice to trust Me. And every generation and every person faces that choice. And when we gather together here and we look at that cross, it reminds us that there was a time when Jesus died for us and He said to us, are you going to believe in Me and follow Me? And today, if you don't know Jesus, you face that choice as every generation and every individual has. Will you believe? We have a memorial that we call the Lord's Table. It's a time when we come and we celebrate who Jesus is. And at that time, more than ever, we have to stop and ask ourselves, do I believe? If you've never put your faith in Jesus Christ and trusted Him, right now is when you should. Right now is when you can. And all you have to do is say, I know that I need Jesus. I don't have to look any farther than the mirror to know that I'm a sinner and I have needs. But Jesus, He came, He died, He rose again, and He promised if you believe in Him, you will have everlasting life. He will forgive your sins, He will make you His child, and He will bring you to be with Him for all eternity. But right now you have the choice. These memorials remind us of the heritage won. Every time we come to that table, we recognize that it's a heritage of redemption. It has its grounding in something called the Passover that goes right back to the stories that Joshua is talking about. There's a heritage of God loving and redeeming His people, and it goes to the people of Israel, and it goes to the church, and it comes to us today. And when we stop and think about that heritage, in my case, it goes back to a man who gave his life in the 1500s because he wouldn't renounce Jesus. And it comes down to grandfather and grandfather and grandmother and grandmother and father and mother and me, and I pass it on to my children. And I gather at that table, that memorial, and it's all there, my heritage. As believers, we have peace. Oh, not just peace in that we're not fighting wars, but peace with God. We have a sense of understanding that our guilt is forgiven and our opportunities are great, and we live in this hope, and we not need fear, judgment. We're also reminded that it had a price. We honor that price. We look at that cross and we pick up those elements and we say, the very God of the universe paid the price for my sin. And in that I can rejoice and be thankful. Memorials, they do good things. They focus us on choices we're made and allow us to make wiser ones. They remind us of a heritage won and let us desire to keep that heritage strong. They allow us to reflect on what it is to have the peace we enjoy and to make sure we pass that on, and they remind us of the price paid so we will never forget and always honor it. As we gather this Memorial Day, I hope that you will leave excited about being American, thankful for what we experience and enjoy, aware of the price paid and grateful for it, committed to carrying it forward, and I hope that you will leave as a Christian equally excited about who we are and what we have and the opportunity to share it with others that they might know. Memorial Day. It's a great day to be an American and to be a Christian. Father, thank You for this time. We ask You to allow these blessings to penetrate our hearts. We pray that we will leave here encouraged and strengthened and more excited about the service we offer our nation and about the service we offer our God. This we pray in Jesus' precious name. Amen.